In the last 5 months, Boston 2024 has had no end of opportunities to disabuse the notion that there is nothing more than a poorly planned ego trip for some of Boston's elite. So how have they fared? Andrew Zimbalist joins us to reassess the situation. He's a professor of economics at Smith College. His latest book, Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. Andrew, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Andrew?
Oops. Is he there?
Andrew, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, we can.
Can you hear us?
Hello to you, Andrew.
I can hear you fine.
Oh,
great.
Good. Okay.
I think I said good morning and good to be with you again.
Oh,
well,
I'm
good
sorry.
Morning and good to have you, Andrew.
Thank you very much. So, and I also want to say that Joe Kelly will win the Cy Young Award before the Boston Olympics happens without using public money.
Well, thank you for being with us,
well,
Andrew.
Well, that may preclude my first question, but I'm going to ask you this anyway, Professor Zimbalist, because we had the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh, in here yesterday at Boston Public Radio, and he was talking about taxpayer dollars for the Olympics. I'm going to play you Jim's question to him and what Walsh had to say.
Okay. Have you been convinced by Boston 2024 yet that they have a mechanism where the taxpayers of Boston or the taxpayers of Massachusetts wouldn't be on the hook for an additional dime?
No, I haven't been convinced yet. I haven't been shown the roadmap yet for that.
Now, Professor Zimbalist, Mayor Walsh is a big labor guy, I'm sure, like a lot of the people you cited, the construction people, there's a lot of people that would like to, you know, have people make some good money working the Olympics. But do you think there is this roadmap, this way to get to the Olympics without spending that taxpayer dollars on anything besides what we talked about, the certain infrastructure and stuff?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, the infrastructure itself is interesting because they were initially talking about just over $5 billion, and they said that all of that money was already appropriated, which wasn't true even in their initial bid documents that they showed us. There was $1 billion worth of that $5 billion that wasn't appropriated. It would require accelerating around half of the projected spending from 20 years out to 10 years out. That would be additional money. And they vastly underestimated a lot of the costs involved. It's estimated by the head of the Transportation Committee in the House that the total bill in infrastructure would be really $13 billion and not $5 billion. But beyond that, the numbers for the operating expenses of the games themselves are very misleading, and there's at least a $1 billion deficit there. And the whole venue budget, in my mind, is incomprehensible. The notion that they're going to be private companies that want to put $550 million into building an Olympic stadium that will be around for a month and then be torn down just defies common sense, and similarly for other venues. And moreover, the bids, the elements of the bid that we've seen so far are all really bare bones. What's going to happen if Boston is indeed the U.S. representative as of September of this year, and we don't know that for sure yet, but if they are the representative, then they're going to be involved in first about an 8-month competition to go from the applicant stage to the candidate stage. And then if they make it to the candidate stage, they'll be in a competition for a year and a half to win out over Paris and Hamburg and Rome and maybe Budapest. And all of those cities are going to be putting forward venue plans that are more elaborate and more extensive than our own. Already we know that the Paris plan is to use the Stade de France, which has an 80,000 capacity as their Olympic stadium, with luxury seats and premium seats. And the plan that they've put before, the Boston 2024 committee has put before us, is a 60,000-seat stadium without premium seating. So they're going to have to do a lot of convincing, first of the people in Boston and Massachusetts, then of the USOC, and then, of course, of the IOC. All of that is going to raise the initial projected costs very, very substantially.
Andrew Zimbalist, though, if Steve Pell, I'm going to have to play Steve Pagliuca or Rich Davey because we can't get either of them to come on the show, so let me play the part for a minute. I guess my response to that would be, if I were Pagliuca in particular, but wait a second, Andrew Zimbalist. The IOC, the International Olympic Committee, has embraced this Agenda 2020 that's all about sustainability, existing structures. So essentially, a low-budget economic game is exactly what they're looking for, and we're it. So what's wrong with that argument?
Well, so what's wrong with that argument is that the IOC, going way back to the 1990s, began to talk about the importance of sustainability, began to talk about the importance of combating gigantism. in the structures, in the venues for the Olympics, began to talk about frugality, began to talk about emphasizing human rights, began to talk about flexibility in the bid procedures. Agenda 2020 is just something that reifies all that and puts it in one package, and is, I think it's been a really effective public relations spin. And Boston can go and say, well, here's an opening. This is an opening that's never existed before. But really, it has existed. Maybe Bach is putting a little bit more emphasis in those directions, and maybe the situation is a little bit more flexible, and maybe instead of spending $18 billion like London did on hosting the Olympic Games, maybe you could spend $17 billion today. You know, it's interesting. I think that really there's been so much emphasis on the spin here, on the public relations, and so much inability to grapple with the hard substantive issues. We're told that some of that will come at the end of this month. But I received a phone call about 3 weeks ago, right after Mr. Pagliuca had been appointed as the chair of the Boston 2024. I couldn't believe my ears, practically. He started the phone call by saying...
Wait, from Pagliuca you got this call?
This is a phone call from Steve Pagliuca,
okay,
who
ahead.
Said, Andy, you know, I've just read your book, Circus Maximus. I think it's a terrific book, and I think it's really... It really gives us the roadmap to show us how we can do this right in Boston. And he said, I'd like you to work for me. I want you to consult for us and be on our executive committee. And I, of course, said thanks a lot, but I'm not going to do that because I think it's a really thankless task, and it's going to fail. And you've misidentified all of the necessary components of doing this the right way. We talked for about 30 or 45 minutes on the phone, and I explained to him piece by piece why I thought it wasn't going to work not to use public money, and why it wouldn't work in a broader sense, and why there was really no great gains at the end of the day, even if you didn't spend public money. And what I discovered, at least in my mind, was that Steve, as well-intentioned as he is and as committed as he is to the city of Boston, which is all very commendable, he didn't have a deep understanding. And he said to me, look, you know, I've just come into this job. I have to spend more time looking at these issues before I can respond to you. So I think that, you know, changing the chair of Boston 2024, putting Larry Bird on the committee, putting Big Poppy on the committee, bringing along past Olympians, all of that is lovely, but none of it deals with the fundamental issue of how do you do this in an economically sensible way. And frankly, I think it's too late. Although it's very heartening to see the proposals that have just come out of the Metropolitan Area Planning Council.
We'll get to them
wait
in a second.
Professor Zimbalist, you just said something very startling there. I mean, I think when people think of the chief opponent of the Olympics in Boston, the person that's been most outspoken, you are the one. I mean, you've written books about it. You've talked to the radio and television about it. So you're telling me that you, the biggest opponent, was offered a job by the new guy that's running the Olympics? To what? To come over to the dark side and embrace his
team of rivals?
Yes.
Well, I don't want to call it the dark side. I just think it's the wrong side. And yes, he asked me to consult for them. And
did
I was surprised.
Did he give you a dollar figure and tell you how much he was going to offer you to come consult?
I haven't discussed that with him, but perhaps you'd like to be my agent. I'll give you 10%.
No, but in all seriousness, is this a team of rivals kind of thing? Was he saying to you, I mean, I assume he knew what your position was when
sure.
he made that offer.
Sure. And he couched it all in terms of him liking my book and that I had some substance to contribute and some ideas to contribute. And maybe all of that had a grain of truth to it, but I suspect that the real point, and this is why I mentioned it in terms of spin, the real point was to take one of his arch critics, or not his, but the Boston 2024 efforts arch critics, and bring me over to their side, and then he could say to the rest of the state, when he presents in a few weeks the final ideas about the venues and the financing, he could say, look, even Andy Zimbalist has been convinced that we're on the right track right now.
Okay. I don't want to get carried away here, but the tabloid reporter in me would say that it looks to me like someone was trying to buy you off.
Well, I'll let you draw your own conclusions. Talking... It didn't work. If that's what he was trying to do, it hasn't worked so far.
Okay. And, yeah.
We're talking to Andrew Zimbalist, sports economist, professor at Smith College. He's the author of Circus Maximus, and I guess you could say almost a consultant, but not, to Boston 2024. You know, you mentioned Bach a minute ago, who we should identify him, the president of the IOC. At the same time that he's talking about sustainability and this Agenda 2020 thing, isn't he the same character who was praising Sochi, $51 billion Sochi, as a, quote, successful games? I mean, sort of the antithesis of Agenda 2020?
Yes, and not only that, but he's also the same character that a few weeks ago, along with some committee members, issued a report that praised the China effort to host the 2022 Winter Olympics, or the Beijing/China effort. And this is right after China refused to reveal the cost of a high-speed railroad that they're going to build between, actually two of them, or actually it's three. One of them is just a short distance. Three high-speed railroads to connect Beijing to the two ski resorts that they're proposing to use for the Winter Olympics that are in Outer Mongolia, that are roughly 120 miles away from Beijing, which is a project that's going to cost tens of billions of dollars. And China refused to release the cost of that on the grounds that they said that those high-speed rails were going to be built anyway, and therefore they're not part of the Olympic cost. And what Bach actually said is, this is a great proposal by China, and it adheres to our new principle of frugality. And so the only way they were able to be frugal was by not releasing the costs of one of the major expense items in the Olympic plan.
You know, Andrew Zimbalist, one of the things that has mystified us, because Marjorie and I, and I'm sure you know a decent percentage of the leaders of this thing, most of whom have a history of competency, of success, of public spiritedness. When it became clear, based on a Freedom of Information request by Boston Magazine and the Boston Business Journal, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, a week and a half ago, that there were essentially two sets of books, that what Boston 2024 was telling the USOC about public money and what it'd be used for, including hundreds of millions of dollars for land acquisition, as opposed to what it was telling the public and elected officials from Elizabeth Warren on down, that would only be used for transportation and related infrastructure. They had to know that at some point this was going to get out. So how do you explain people with this level and record of accomplishment being so keystone cop-like? I'm serious. I don't get this at all.
I think it's a very good question. You should be addressing it to a psychologist and not an economist. it's baffling in a way. I agree with you. And the budgetary shenanigans is not all that was going on. I mean, there's lots of other stuff that they told us. They told us that they, at least the bid document said that they had spoken to the landowners in Wedette Circle and in Columbia Point, who owned the land that they were going to need to do some of their venue construction. And they hadn't. It turns out they hadn't spoken to them. So I think part of the problem is that there's been a lot of miscommunication within the people of Boston 2024, initially between Jim Fish and his lieutenants, and now John Fish, and now with Steve Pagliuca. There hasn't been a consistency in the leadership. And I think that the leadership has been too concentrated on spin. First, they were spinning to the USOC, and then they started spinning to us.
We're talking to Andrew Zimbalist. He's a professor of economics at Smith College. Professor Zimbalist, one thing I was kind of hoping, and maybe this is a ridiculous position on my part, but you know, you read about other things like how New York, which put in a bid and ultimately lost, but got things like the High Line, which is this really cool thing above ground. You walk through Chelsea. It's got beautiful plantings and benches, and it's just a spectacular piece of public art, I guess. Well, I don't know if you call it public art, but whatever, in New York City and other cities that have tried to get the bid and lost have done some improvements. I was hoping, because the T, as you probably know, is such a disaster here in Boston, and I'm really worried about the economy of the city if we can't fix the T, that the best thing would be for us to bid and lose so we could make these sort of improvements that we need and we've neglected to do and then lose. Is there any silver lining in my position?
Well, sure. But, you know, I'm baffled when I hear this over and over again. And there's been a lot of publicity and propaganda about what happened in Atlanta in 1996. And I know that Dr. O has been involved in the Boston 2020, Dr. Off, excuse me. And he's been talking about how different things in New York happened because of New York bidding for the 2012 Olympic Games. But really, can't we have some of these innovations? Couldn't we have had the walkway that you're talking about on the Lower East Side Lower West Side without having had a bid for the Olympics? Can't people do some planning without having the Olympics as a possibility? It seems to me we have to learn how to do that. And the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, I think, has come up with some interesting ideas in that regard. But you don't have to have the planning around the Olympics. You can just have city planning.
Okay, we're talking with the professor of economics at Smith College, Andrew Zimbalist, who's been one of the critics of the Olympics in Boston. His book is called Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. When we come back, we're going to talk with Professor Zimbalist a little bit about the travails of soccer and the World Cup and FIFA. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Just for a couple of additional minutes, we're talking Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College. His latest book, Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup, which is what we want to speak to Andy about just for another couple of minutes.
Yeah, so there have been all these terrible stories about corruption in FIFA, and everybody knows that the authorities went in and arrested people in their hotel in handcuffs, and the president that was reelected has just give up his position and so forth. Was any of this a surprise to you, or did you expect this sooner or later to come down the pike, Andrew Zimbalist?
Well, the timing was a surprise. I think that those of us who were following FIFA knew that the U.S. Justice Department was looking into this and had their interest piqued after we being the United States, did not win the bid to host the 2022 World Cup, and it was given to Qatar, which made no sense whatsoever and has been so far an utter disaster. And there was already some evidence way back in December of 2011 when that decision was made. There was already evidence that people had been bought, votes had been bought within FIFA, within the executive committee. And so the U.S. Justice Department has been on this case. Now, the fact that they did it during the Congress when it was happening in Zurich was, I think, a little bit surprising to me. But they did the right thing. They went after the people mostly connected to the regional organization of FIFA that's called CONCACAF that had done dealings with U.S. financial centers and U.S. banks. So they had hard evidence on those people. These are the second rung of officials in FIFA. They're called vice presidents. They're Sepp Blatter. Sepp Blatter is the president. They're Sepp Blatter's lieutenants. And if you can get them to talk about their experience in FIFA, as Jack Warner has said he will do, and others, Chuck Blazer said he has already done, then you can start connecting the dots and get up to Jerome Valka, who's just below Sepp Blatter, and then eventually to Sepp Blatter himself. So I think that Blatter saw this coming and wanted to head it off a little bit. The other thing that he saw coming was that UEFA, the European FIFA branch, had made some noises about not participating in the 2018 World Cup in Russia. And that would just be absolutely devastating to FIFA if that happened, because if the European countries had their own World Cup in Europe instead of in Western Europe instead of in Russia, the United States would join and Canada would join that, and probably Brazil and Chile and Argentina and South Korea and Japan would join that. It would have blown the whole thing to smithereens. And so Blatter had to do something. He said he would resign. He hasn't resigned yet, and I'm hopeful that he'll be indicted before this December or January election to find his replacement, because if that doesn't happen, he's going to be machinating and scheming behind the scenes to put somebody in there who's close to him, and he'll end up being an Eminence Grease.
Well, my last question then is obvious, Andrew Zimbalist. If Sepp Blatter were to call you today and offer you a job as a consultant...
I'm sorry, I'm already working for Steve Pagliuca. Don't have any time.
Andrew Zimbalist, we really appreciate your time and
always
sharing
a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah,
that information
you.
With us.
Thank you very much. Andrew Zimbalist is a professor of economics at Smith College. His latest book, Circus Maximus, the economic gamble behind hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. Professor Zimbalist, thank you again so much for joining us.
So what do you think of that?
Well, I think
Steve Pagliuca took over, what, 2-3 weeks ago. Apparently, almost immediately after taking over Boston 2024, he calls the lead highest profile critic of Boston 2024 and offers him a consulting job.
We have a very sarcastic email here from one of our suspicious listeners,
Yikes.
Jack, who says, Boston 2024 offered a critic a job? Shocker. There is no corruption here.
Well, I don't know. Corruption. I mean, it really is. I mean, it is a variation on the theme. Team of Rivals, for those who know, one of the unbelievable books of Darce Kearns Goodwin.
Well, hold on
but
for a second.
I'm going to make the distinction.
Abraham Lincoln's motives were pure. He wanted people to disagree with him because he thought you'd have a more robust.
You don't think Steve Pagliuca wanted somebody in-house who could be a loyal opposition
again,
critic?
Again, I don't know, but you
I'm
think
kidding,
to yourself that perhaps he thought, you know,
you can buy off opposition.
Money could change. I mean, I don't know. I'm casting aspersions where I don't know. But let's put it this way, Jim. It doesn't look good. It's another nail in the coffin, I would say, of
I thought Zimbalist was kidding
at first. I thought he was kidding, too.
But apparently not.
Okay. Another beautiful move by Boston 2024. Okay. Coming
up. Can I say one last thing? If you're Pagliuca, I know Zimbalist a little bit. He's an honorable guy. And you have that conversation. Wouldn't you say to Zimbalist, by the way, this is dead man's talk. This doesn't go any further. But apparently, he did not.
Yeah.
Sorry, okay.
I don't get it. Coming up, we're going to talk to Congressman Stephen Lynch about Usama Ramin. He was on the FBI's radar since 2012. Lynch saw the documentation. That's up next on 89.7 WGBH.